You think President Kennedy should have resigned? Do you believe President Johnson should have resigned? Someone should ask you these questions because of the way you formulate the questions. I dealt with it 20 years ago plus, and the American people, two-thirds of them stayed with me, and I've tried to do a good job since then with my life and with my work. That's all I have to say to you.
You missed him, didn't you, America? That's Bill Clinton. He hasn't taken a drink of water in 20 years. And he's back making headlines for the Clinton family because we missed him so much. Welcome to the recent podcast, Monday Editors Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch. Thanks for listening to us. Please stop what you're doing and go subscribe to us on iTunes right now. We'll wait. One, two. Okay, glad you did that. We are here with Catherine Megan Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Peter Suderman. And, you know, we try to put these things together and come up with a program. And then before you know it, the Bill Clinton is out there talking about JFK. And then the masterpiece cake shop SCOTUS ruling came down. So we're going to try to get to a lot of things in a brief period of time here. But let's just start off very quickly with Bill Clinton saying, asking Craig Melvin whether he thinks JFK should resign. Catherine Mengu Ward, I'm going to go with you first. Should JFK and Lyndon Johnson and just all of them have resigned?
I do think, I mean, this is a parlor game that we've been playing in D.C. and in the D.C. office for a while now. What if Monica Lewinsky happens during the Me Too era? How does this go down differently? Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. How does this happen differently? How does this occur differently? and I think, yeah, I think in the Me Too era, the it was consensual claim has less power, and the there was a different power dynamic claim has more power. And I think it's much more likely that Clinton would have resigned had this exact same scandal broken today. I can't speak to the JFK question, but that's because I'm young.
Nick, I think you probably share my basic reaction to all this, which is what the living fletch is Bill Clinton doing writing a novel?
What the living flesh. Not only is he writing a novel, he's writing it with James Patterson, who excretes, you know, 200 or 250 books a year, including the middle school Worst Years of My Life series, which was enjoyable. My problem is really that James Patterson was the guy who led a media backlash against Amazon a few years ago when they wanted to only charge $9.99 or less for ebooks. He was part of the cabal that claimed he would, you know, he would go Galt's Gulch and stop writing if he couldn't pay, you know, if he couldn't force people to pay $15 or more for an ebook. So fuck him. Having said all of this, of course, all the Kennedys should, you know, with the exception of Lisa Kennedy, our pal on Fox Business, all the Kennedys everywhere should resign all of the time. To go to Catherine's claim, I think it's more complicated. I think let's say you have the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky situation coming out now. A lot of it would depend on whether or not how Hillary responded. Would she respond in the same way or not? Would Monica speak? And what would Clinton do? I actually think, and I think this is generally a good thing, I think we're past the, you know, the idea that sex in the workplace or among workplace people specifically.
Stammering.
Yeah. But is, you know, is not necessarily a scandal if it was consensual. And I think what Donald Trump has shown, I mean, Donald Trump has, you know, there's the pussy grabbing comments. There's the whole thing about Stormy Daniels. There's the, you know, other affairs that have come out. And people don't really seem to care overly much in terms of, I mean, people like to talk about it. A lot of parlor games going on. And but having said that, you know, it doesn't seem like this is going to be grounds for impeachment.
Suderman, to that point, Bill Clinton, when he was croaking back at Craig Melvin at some most of it, I think, was kind of garbage. There's gaping holes in your presentation of facts. But one point that he made that I think is worth you engaging, carrying on what Nick was just saying, he said, intimated that we don't cover Donald Trump in the same way. Like this consumed I presume, Peter, your high school entire career, this scandal, constantly based on one, or if you include the Linda, what's her face, or Paula Jones scandal, a couple of relationships, whereas Trump has just thousands, or feels like it, and we kind of roll our eyes at it. So Clinton is saying that there's a double standard here. Is that true, Peter Sudeman? And also, how about your high school in Florida?
I'm pretty certain. I can't swear to this like in a court of law, but I'm fairly certain that the first time that I ever even heard of downloading a PDF was when the Star Report was posted online, and you could download the thing and read it, and it was kind of this like fantastic, strange moment
in
history.
Did you download it from thesmokinggun.com?
I you know what? I just want to interject
here.
What a
great site.
Yeah.
Still around, too.
Long may it wave. I just want to interject here that I really thought that if Suderman was a human and not a robot, this sentence would have gone the first time I heard the word blowjob was X, but it's downloaded.
And then, like, the first time I downloaded a PDF, I thought that was going to go different, too.
Matt, ask him whether or not the Brooklyn Dodgers are going to win the American League this year. I think we've got some kind of trans species.
So here's the thing, though. Like, Peter and I are we're a little bit older, but I do suspect there are at least some people a couple of years younger than us who learned about the birds and the bees from the Star Report, right? Like, for sure.
Well, probably
and they
from
are
the
confused
coverage of the
still,
Star
maybe.
Report. I mean, when you're nine years old, that's like a pretty intense, weird thing to be reading, or whatever. When you're 11 or whatever it is,
from the cover show, from the secondary effects,
the actual report about it, right?
Yeah.
Like I certainly learned about much to my parents' frustration. I distinctly remember them coming in and taking away probably U.S. News, but possibly Time Magazine, because I was reading an extended feature story about sex workers and about some of their seedy advertising techniques and how they write and like this
Did
whole thing.
Did you keep a copy of U.S. News under your mattress, Peter?
No, I just read it in the living room.
Was that
where,
in the
where my parents
news
kept
you can
it
use,
on the coffee like, table?
With the fake typewriter font and everything in it, Peter, you were really.
We were big
news
magazine readers in my house, and big local newspaper readers. It wasn't until later, until I was a junior or senior, that we really started having the New York Times and sort of larger newspapers around on a regular basis, just because it was often difficult to get them.
What is the question, though? Because it seems to me that, Bill Clinton. It wasn't a double standard, or it's not a double standard. Standards have changed.
I just want to add in here that the question of double standards is one that has been raised an awful lot, and in particular by Al Franken, who ended up resigning because of some instances of forced kissing, sort of groping, and he was very clearly pretty resentful about it. And his sort of parting shot was. Basically, look, I really just don't like I'm not saying I didn't do anything wrong, but I really don't think that whatever I did rose at all to the level of having me of forcing me to lose my seat. And in fact, and he said, let me see if I can pull up the quote here. His parting shot was, I of all people am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party. And so, this is, I think something that that people are going to be kind of asking, that people have been asking already, and that is going to play an interesting and pivotal role in probably sort of the future of our politics and a lot of people's careers.
I just think that the Clinton family inability to go away is just stunning in its tenacity. Yeah. No one.
Why would Bill Clinton go away? And didn't they come looking for him? I mean, he's just trying to tend his own garden.
If he's
in
just
Chappaqua.
Trying to use his name to write a thriller and make more money.
True.
Here's an interesting side question that I really feel needs to be asked: who actually wrote that book? Because the whole thing about James Patterson is he doesn't write his books.
Yeah.
He employs a staff of co-authors, and then he does go through and sort of revise and sometimes will pen whole chapters himself.
But
he
Bill
basically
Clinton might actually write his
so
books
was
because
James,
they're like
did
just logarithmic.
It's Milo. Milo Yiannopoulos' is ghostwriters. Yeah. Milo Yiannopoulos is. They've got nothing to do anymore
I think Bill Clinton wrote the first draft, and then James Patterson's ghostwriters went through and turned it into a James Patterson book.
And
that's
then James Patterson read it and was like,
"Fine,
a little bit more like this, a little bit less like that." Like,
if
like
that.
He basically served as the editor on his ghostwriters' draft. That makes the most sense.
That's my
Except
theory.
Typically now, James Patterson's ghostwriters, if I'm not mistaken, typically they do get some sort of credit, and there's only two names on the cover here. Which
yeah,
is a
things start
bit.
To get crowded once you get to three bylines.
Do we care?
Things are getting crowded in this rabbit hole.
Do
people.
We care?
So
about
I'm going
that,
to.
Alexander Dumas.
That's the motto, by the way, of the Reason podcast. Things are getting crowded in this rabbit hole.
They are, and I'm going to pull us back out
of
the Alexander Dumas nightmare world. Although, did he invent D'Artagnan? Because if so, then I'm
I realize everything. Now there's a pair and a fee and what the fuck.
Before we go beyond the James Patterson thing,
what?
I
We're
need to add one little story that I recall
you
from
don't.
A profile of him in which he said that, you know, after kind of writing novels on the side while being an ad exec, he came up with this idea that he really wanted to expand his presence and he wanted to write books for people who were afraid of the idea of reading a book.
Yeah.
Well, I think he succeeded beyond his wildest dreams.
So,
and mine too.
Speaking of dreams, the Supreme Court this morning, minutes before we pressed record on this and failed, but we'll just skip past that podcast, ruled
sour
in
grapes
in a wide. A large majority, narrow ruling on the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, 7-2.
What does that mean, Matt? A large majority, narrow
7-2.
Ruling?
Yeah, this okay. is what Twitter
the ruling,
is fighting about right now. It was a 7-2
yes.
or maybe 6-2, depending on how you count, ruling, but it was ruled on narrow grounds, and the AP described it as a narrow ruling, and then everyone lost their minds perfectly on cue.
So, Catherine, since you've written about this in the past, can you walk us through the narrow-wide distinction and also your kind of preliminary takeaway from this?
So my main takeaway here is that Stephanie Slade was right. So she wrote about this back in December of last year and basically predicted what happened here, which was that because the Civil Rights Commission were such assholes that – offered the court an opportunity to create this narrow ruling. So they basically, I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing, obviously, but I read the beginning of it. And one thing that's really, really striking is that the decision centers so much on tone and the words like respectful and neutral. Basically, what they ended up saying is, listen, they're ruling in favor of Masterpiece Cake Shop, but they are doing so in large part because there seems to be pretty clear evidence that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission treated their religious beliefs with disrespect, that they purposefully discounted that as a valid reason for refusing to produce this cake, and that... In a sort of parallel case where the positions were reversed, they didn't do the same. So this is just the beginning of a whole new lawsuit journey in which everyone will sue everyone forever to further clarify the law, which is how these things work, and that's okay. But what this ruling did was basically say religious beliefs need to be treated with respect. And it also, as far as I can tell, and I suspect that further commentary will illuminate this further, but as far as I can tell, it sort of smudges together a little bit the distinctions between the free expression elements and the free exercise elements of this case. And I think that'll be interesting to see teased out later. Is the main thing religious people are allowed to be religious, or is the main thing you can't coerce people to speak sentiments they don't actually hold. So it's a really interesting ruling. As far as I can tell, it just means everyone back to your courtrooms for lots more.
The relevant quote about the commission's treatment of the Baker's case is that it showed elements of a clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious beliefs motivating his objection. As the record shows, some of the commissioners at the commission's formal public hearings endorsed the view that religious beliefs cannot legitimately be carried into the public sphere or commercial domain.
And this is what Stephanie Slade said in December. The justices might have found a sort of get-out-of-jail-free card, allowing them not to make such a tricky ruling. In stark language, several questioned whether anti-religious animus may have motivated the Colorado Civil Rights Commission's judgment against Phillips. So this is what we saw coming, and it means that basically if people weren't such jerks, we might have more clarity right now, but unfortunately, people are jerks.
Nick, forgive me if I'm going to mischaracterize your views, but my sense is that when you've discussed this in the past, don't heavy sigh on me yet, you've kind of stressed this isn't necessarily a hill for civil libertarians or libertarians to die on. Is that kind of correct? Or just maybe put it straight up to you, is from your point of view, decorating a cake an expressive act of speech that shouldn't be the government has no business getting into?
Yeah, I mean, these are interesting questions that aren't really being addressed. And the fact is that the cake baker eventually said, at first it seemed like he was saying, I'll make a cake, but I won't decorate it a certain way. And then he was like, no, I'm just not making you a cake, which is a different matter. And I think even a lot of the people who talk about this in terms of who would defend the guy's religious rights not to engage in expressive behavior wouldn't necessarily say he has a right to just say no, because I know you're gay and I know you're going to use this cake at your wedding.
That's the Wally Olson position, right? Which is,
yeah, no,
which is a pretty good, respectable one for sure.
Thank you. It's also Eugene Volokh who adds to that that cake baking is not an expressive act, that it's not the same as writing a novel, or it's not the same as political sloganeering. That I'm not sure exactly how I feel about all of that stuff. So, Matt, I'll say a couple things. One is that I do think that libertarians are too quick to say that the public accommodation laws that, you know, that generally we trace back to civil rights acts in the mid-60s, redefining a private business as a public accommodation are wrong. There's a longer legal history to that that goes back through English common law, where it was the case that if you put your shingle out to serve one person in a commercial setting, you have to serve everybody who is not illegal in your society, meaning a criminal or something like that. And I think that, libertarians haven't grappled with that, because they're, we have a lot of glibness about how, like, oh, this, you know, of course you shouldn't have to serve anybody you want. But then very few people, I think, are really willing, nor should they be, to say, like, oh, and by the way, you know, it's not just gays. We should also be blocking blacks and other groups, et cetera. Like, I think there's a philosophical argument to be had there, related within the libertarian space. I think another question to ask is, in 5 or 10 years, is anybody going to be talking about this any more than like we talk about, oh, it's okay to kick blacks out of your restaurant? No, things are already changing. So in a way, I think this is occupying a huge amount of space precisely because it doesn't actually matter that much. As a society, we are moving so far past this that we can argue about last year or yesteryear's debates a lot more easily than stuff that actually matters. So having said all of that, in this case, I think that the guy should have had to give them a cake. I don't think he should have had to have written anything expressive on it. And another thing, and this is, I was just looking at some stuff about John McAfee, who ran for the Libertarian Party presidential nomination in 2016. One thing he said in a John Stossel hosted debate on Fox Business that I thought was right. He said, because on the one side there was Gary Johnson, who kind of hemmed and hawed and then said, like, I just, you know, the guy should be forced to bake the cake. That upset a lot of people. On the other side, there was Austin Peterson saying he should not be, and I would be protesting that store for being bigoted, which is, you know, is a good libertarian response. But McAfee said, you know, in this case, he shouldn't have to, partly because there were so many other options for the people looking for the cake. And that it might be a different story if you lived in a place where for 500 miles around you, there was no other place to buy a wedding cake, a decorated wedding cake. And actually, I think that kind of thoughtfulness is worth considering in this kind of case.
Suderman, I honestly apologize in advance for bringing up the Florida man thing again. But when Nick was just talking about how things change calls to mind that Florida was kind of the leading state fighting the scourge, if that's pronounced correctly.
Nope. Scourge.
Thanks.
You've gone back to Anita Bryant? Are you dusting off your Anita Bryant?
No, no. I should, but gay adoption, right? They were the state, and I think even Jeb Bush was against gay adoption back in the day. And like, when is the last time any human being in the country said it was a bad idea for gay couples to adopt someone? Yet that was a really, really important thing in Florida and elsewhere. So just a quick Florida man, Suderman, from your childhood to now, what are some things that just don't exist that were huge, huge kind of social politics conflicts, if any, come to mind?
So one that really comes to mind, it's fairly obvious, but is medical marijuana. And in particular in Florida, where a medical – I think I'm going to get the stats a little bit wrong here, but a medical marijuana legislation or proposition failed a few years back, and then like 4 years later – passed with something like 71% support. It like in the space of certainly in less than a decade, and I think it was in less than 5 years, support for medical marijuana in Florida just radically shifted. People went from thinking, wow, this is way too far, we can't, to basically everyone thinking, yeah, this is not a big deal, let's go ahead and do it. These people are in pain. It's probably not going to hurt them. And I mean, I remember in my Florida public high school being taught about how, you know, if you smoke pot, it's, and you're a guy, it's going to give you feminine features. It's going to like basically turn you into a woman who
turned
can't
out it wasn't
graduate.
Marijuana. It was soy.
And
that's going to do that.
I don't even know about the soy business here, because I'm not really a
soy boy,
a soy eater. but stuff like that is, you know, it's, I mean, Florida continues to be an interesting and strange state, in part because it's really best thought of as three states, one of which is Southern Alabama. One of which
I hate
is Northern
that
Cuba.
Exceptional. Every state is at least three states.
And the other one, though, is Southern Ohio. So, I mean, again, you know, it's interesting in that Florida and Ohio are the two states that best represent the country as a whole. And so if you want to sort of pull one little place to figure out where the whole country is, you basically go to either Orlando or Columbus, Ohio, or you can pull Florida or Ohio as whole states. But really, it's even those specific cities. And so Florida and Ohio as bellwethers continue to kind of be interesting and relevant, seeing how they shift politically, because they have for a decade plus really kind of told us where national politics maybe not is going, but where it has gone and where it is at precisely at this moment.
If hey, Orlando
Matt,
and
Matt,
and,
I realize this rabbit hole is already also credit, but can we do a quick poll of, you know, a lot of the background of this is that Christians, a group that now improbably includes Catholics and Protestants joining teams instead of fighting each other, as they were doing 30 and 40 years ago. But there's this, a lot of the background of this is that, you know, Christians in America are somehow really beleaguered. Even though they are by far and away, you know, the most powerful religious group in the country, and they still wield considerable political power and social power and cultural power, they are everywhere under attack, and their beliefs are being mocked and made, you know, run roughshod over and everything. You know, one of the things I want to see coming out of this is that the first time somebody explicitly says, fuck you, I am not making a cake because, you know, I don't believe in your sky god, or something like that, that Christians are like, okay, you know, that's fair, because that's exactly the right that we want. And I these culture war battles really just are driving me to distraction, because the only answer is a principled tolerance and pluralism, which could shade into either not doing anything you don't want to do or having to do a bunch of things that you don't want to do. But I wish that we could talk about this in terms of a principled tolerance and pluralism, rather than this is always going to be done. And this happened with the Hobby Lobby case, you know, of like, right now, this is great, and conservatives can feel charged up, and liberals are back on their heels, and then liberals are on their, you know, and it's just, it bugs the hell out of me. And I think that's just what I needed to say.
I don't think that's so wrong, that there is a sort of a Christian attitude. That kind of Christian conservative thinking drives
it's
an awful lot of this.
Persecution context.
But I also think that it's a mistake to simply say that it exists only on the right with conservative Christians.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a huge amount of this on the liberal left as well, which has basically decided, no, we want to. It's not merely that we want to create a space where we are allowed to be the way we want to be, but instead we want to create an obligation for everyone else to be the way we want them to be a way that they don't want to. And so, and in particular with sort of speech and culture issues, with kinds of what are you obligated to do in the realm of commerce? You see this, you know, sort of we cover these sorts of stories on college campuses all the time. And this to me seems like This has become in some ways more petty and also more heated recently. And I think if we're going to end up talking about the Samantha Bee stuff, we probably will cover a little bit of this territory. But it's not just the Christian right. And I don't want to excuse them or say that the Christian right doesn't do that. They do. And certainly under Trump, they've done it in a way that I think is dumber, more shallow, more hypocritical, more revealing than ever before. But there are also folks on the Christian right who are arguing for a kind of a meaningful, fair pluralism. And I would put, I would put someone like my pal Tim Carney at The Washington Examiner. Mm-hmm. Certainly, our managing editor, Stephanie Slade, she might take issue with her being described as the Christian right.
I'm sure she would, in fact.
But
Another example of this is the Utah Compromise, which is an explicit effort to try an experiment in let's give special protections to both, gay would-be customers and religious people, and to sort of balance it out that way. I'm not sure ultimately that that's where the solution lies, but it is in line with this idea of, trying a kind of pluralism inside the legal debate. And again, in this Masterpiece Cake decision, the parts that I've read, the thing that's really striking about it is that it's about tone. It's about respect. It's not about who's exactly allowed to do what, though it will play out in that arena. But first and foremost, it's about just trying to figure out a way to talk amongst ourselves about these issues in formal and informal contexts that doesn't immediately polarize and alienate everyone. I will point to one other Stephanie Slade oeuvre, since apparently I'm her paid PR agent today.
Yeah, you're her hype man.
I would love to be Stephanie Slade's hype man. I stand for that position every day. A piece in
I'm happy to be your understudy.
A magazine about a year ago called Christian Started the Wedding Wars, and it was about how the effort to wipe out polygamy, in which, quote-unquote traditional Christians worked really, really hard to say that the social consensus about what marriage is had to be enforced across the board, and how they're now they are basically in the position that they put the Mormons in 100 years ago, of being a different, lagging, religiously informed understanding of marriage, and they are officially hoisted on their own petards. I think that's what happens when you don't pursue this pluralist approach.
I think that we should pronounce that word petard from now on.
Sure,
just throwing that out there. Someone, I think maybe Tyler Cowen, was saying that we should welcome those who mispronounce words because it shows that they're very good readers. So that's my go-to excuse for mispronouncing a word, I think, in every single edition of this podcast. Let's segue straight to more double standard culture war outrages.
Matt, I think you meant to say let's segue to the next topic.
Let's cue up. Which is last week, it feels like last year, but it was really just Tuesday, is when Roseanne Barr, nay Connor, tweeted something about Valerie Jarrett.
That's not how that word works either.
Looking like an ape. She said something about George Soros, obviously participating in the Holocaust, usual Roseanne stuff. Immediately fired, or the show Roseanne was canceled after it had finished its first season. This, while we were still digesting all of that, Samantha Bee went on. And for the sins of Ivanka Trump posting a picture of herself and her kid on the Twitter, called her, I think the term was keckless funt. I could be corrected on that. And so that consumed people. Then suddenly everyone wanted to talk about we should fire Bill Maher because why not? And I think the world almost agreed with that. Just a lot of discussion of disproportionality and double standards and kind of manufactured or real outrage. Nick, I want to start with you because I saw you flipping around with Robbie Suave on this.
Robbie Suave.
As he shall henceforth be known.
Robbie tweeted something along the lines of, like, I don't think anybody should be fired for stuff like this. And I think you lashed back. So is Robbie
I did not lash back. I merely asked a question, which has, I don't think, been answered. But is there any circumstance under which somebody should be fired for speech that they do not at the workplace? Because Robbie tends to support anybody's right to say anything. And as a former manager, I take issue with that, in a lot of ways. As a now non-manager, I, of course, agree completely with Robbie. And we should be able to tweet whatever the fuck we want about whoever we want. But having said all of that, this is, we might be in apples and oranges here, but like what Samantha Bee, and she called Ivanka Trump a feckless cunt, which is such a vile and pathetic and unfunny, you know, slander or slur or whatever. It was duly beeped, et cetera. I don't give a shit what TBS does with her. I do know that like her ratings even before this were way down, and people have a right to either listen to her or not. And then also you can pile on and you can say, you know what, that's problematic. I do think it shows something that like her humor is less about, and I think she's really talented and funny, but like she has Trump derangement syndrome, like a lot of comedians. And like, it's not about being funny or clever, making fun of Trump for the most part. It's just attacking him in front of an audience that it's like, oh yeah, you got that right. You know, that Trump, look at his hair. He can't spell, even though he's got those tiny thumbs. You know, he's making all kinds of typos on the Twitter. It's like, you know, that's not very funny. And she's getting her comeuppance in terms of a smaller audience.
It's kind of, funny. I would pay for the Gillespie show.
And then Roseanne, if I was ABC, I'd be like, yeah, you know what? I don't want to be associated with somebody who is essentially, and the tweet was something along the lines of like, oh, well, you know, when you mate the Muslim Brotherhood with Planet of the Apes, you get Valerie Jarrett. And it's like, first off, like, this is as sad as I just saw over the weekend a Charlie Kirk of Turning Point USA thing about how, you know, shitty Obama was because he released a bunch of nonviolent drug offenders on his last day in office. And it's kind of like, is Obama in office? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, why is Roseanne talking about Valerie Jarrett? It's a racist tweet, unambiguously, and I could see why ABC would be like, shit, we just had the biggest hit we've had in decades, but we don't want to be associated with that. So, you know, they're both Catherine, getting their own brand of justice.
Catherine, do we need to have a national conversation about the C word?
Please, no. No, thank you. I actually do always find myself sort of tempted by this like feminist attempt to overthink whether we are supposed to be completely furious every time someone uses that word or whether our fury itself is evidence of misogyny because, hey, what's so bad about that body part anyway, you haters?
Or that you're still in the fainting couch because, like, I thought you guys were tough. You know, you want to mix it up with the guys and drive in the Indy 500, but... You know,
I think the important
thing
here,
single four-letter word makes you go, you know,
the important thing here
control.
Is I want to defend my right to fire Nick for his tweets, both
yes.
on and off the job. So yeah. that's okay. just going to go ahead and put that out there for our podcast listeners. I think the you know, this national moment we're having where everybody is outraged full time about everyone else. I have full faith that we will be reading if there's not already a post live somewhere on the internet there will be soon about all of the people whose lives will be lost as a result of this very, very subtle legalistic Supreme Court decision, right? Like absolutely everything, particularly having to do with identity politics, is immediately a matter of life and death and, you know, black and white political victory or defeat. And, you know, a dumb tweet by Roseanne and a dumb comment by Samantha Bee and a, I think, actually really pretty, from what I can tell, savvy and intelligent Supreme Court decision will all be lumped together in a giant culture war conflagration forever and ever. Amen.
Comedy comes
in threes. I
think
it's the war against boys. You know, this is opening up somehow. I'm sure we'll be, it'll be explained to us all that this is opening up a savage new front in the war against boys.
Peter, I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday who in a different kind of context was more about the Trump-Russia thing, but introduced the metaphor of a kind of society-wise or news cycle-wise DNS attack. So I'm going to you because you understand what those words mean. But like when there's so much stuff, it has the effect of having a DNS attack on like our capacity just to kind of deal with the news. It could be again over here on Trump Russia, but it could also be culture war outrage nonsense, the NFL anthem stuff. Like we have a capacity of 100, and like 73 at least is being taken up by like stupid garbage fights about Twitter outrages. So is that metaphor apt in any way that resonates with you?
Yes, very much. A DNS attack basically is when you overload a web server so that people can't get to it, and so that it's just trying to do too much at one time.
That's why we're not talking about Puerto Rico, man.
Right, that's why we're not talking about Puerto Rico. Look,
isn't that more of a DDoS attack?
I want to DNS, DDoS, whichever. All of these acronyms, I actually don't even. I mean, I'm just pretending to play an expert here on television. So I want to start actually by telling just a short story about my weekend. I was with a friend who reads the news for a living. In particular, this friend reads an awful lot of reads and watches conservative news for a living, but this person is not doing that for this last week, has been off and did very best to delete all of the kind of information streams that might normally
It's going to be so easy to figure out who this person is after the fact.
The
conversation inevitably, conversation turned to Samantha Bee. And this person had not heard about the thing, about Samantha Bee, had instead been like living a normal, semi-sane human life. And so my wife, Megan McArdle, and I were having this conversation and I reached over to Megan and I was like, honey, stop. You can save someone from knowing. You can give them that pleasure. And that is like, that is one small human thing that you can do, is that someone might never know about what happened last week and what we talked about all week. And that person's life will be better. We can't save everyone, but we can save one person. And it was like, I feel like we need that sort of intervention somehow or another on like a national scale. Somehow, like, or maybe I just need it in my own life. I don't know. I don't think this was the worst week, the most horrible or awful week. It might well have been the dumbest week of the Trump presidency. And
why? That was like a hold my beer thing to say. There's so many more weeks left to get dumber.
So far. I'm not saying it will, that this is peak dumb. Peak, like absolute dumb zero has yet to be reached. But I think this might have been the dumbest week of the Trump presidency.
The movement of all brain molecules ceases.
But I will also say this is Trump. The other thing I want to add is that this is Trump's explicit strategy. And there was a report in Axios at the beginning of the year that Trump, that with Republicans basically having no agenda for Congress and Trump not really having a whole lot that he particularly wanted to do, this was what he wanted to do. And there were Trump insiders saying that his plan for year two was to look for culture war flashpoints that he could exploit. This is and Samantha Bee and Roseanne and everybody else playing exactly into this, and then our president is blowing it up himself. And then, of course, because the president gets involved and says stuff, that makes it news. You can't not cover what the president says. You can't do the polite thing of saying, let's save this person from knowing when the president says it. And so
right, but let's point out,
in this
bind. So what did Trump do this week? By the way, because in a way, it almost seems like, and I realize I'm about to be proven dead wrong, but it didn't seem like he was at the vanguard of the stupidity of this week.
Well, let me answer by way
of the amplifier. He tweeted about this stuff. And again, when the president of the United States decides to get involved in the Roseanne firing or what Samantha Bee says, when the president decides to make a statement that makes it national news and means that cable news and the major newspapers have, to some extent, an obligation to discuss it.
He did meet with Kim Kardashian to talk about prison reform. So
yes,
that was great.
Yeah.
Right. And then he pardoned Dinesh D'Souza.
Hold on.
God, was that this week?
Let me do the segueing here,
sorry,
people.
Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, what are you going to have for lunch?
Go ahead and segue, Matt.
My segue is just that kind of to split the difference between Nick and Peter is that, yeah, so Trump met with Kim Kardashian, and so that makes news. But the reaction to it is phenomenal. I mean, terrible. Like the New Yorker had the stupidest week
of the presidency.
A nightmare we can't wake up from. Seeing Kim Kardashian, seeing a successful female entrepreneur celebrity use her power at the White House to try to get an unjustly imprisoned woman out of prison. Catherine, why isn't that the future liberals want?
It's definitely the future libertarians want. Like, I definitely think anybody who can march into the Oval Office and get Donald Trump's time for a cause like prison and sentencing reform is they have my vote in the next election. I'm looking forward to the Trump Kardashian ticket. And I think, I mean, that like so much of this does come down to whether the sort of theatrics and hysteria are for a good cause or not. And this is something that is very hard, at least for me, to disentangle, right? Like, when people get really, really, really upset about, you know, a tweet from Roseanne or a comment from Samantha Bee, one mental exercise that I try to do is like, okay, well, what if I think that like unchallenged public racism on the part of powerful people is the worst thing happening in our society? What reaction is justified? And the answer is totally go nuclear. I am not convinced that, in fact, the worst thing happening in our society is dumb Roseanne tweets about Valerie Jarrett. But I do think one of the worst things happening in our society is mass incarceration. And so, you know, I'm willing to overlook or at least bargain down the seeming triviality of Kim Kardashian in the White House because it was for something that was both theoretically fixable and also something that matters.
Shouldn't the 2020 ticket be Kardashian Trump, not Trump Kardashian?
You know what? We'll let the voters decide.
Throw in Kanye West. Come on.
Right. But we're going to get to that, Nick.
We're going to get to Kanye West.
Of course, like the big macro issues of... Sorry, everyone.
Yeah,
are you hitting Larry Fine or Curly Howard over there?
I'm actually making that noise with my mouth.
Nick,
let's pick that up so we can cut out my
voice. No, we should keep it. Yeah. Absolutely should keep it. Nick, we mentioned before the pardoning of Dinesh D'Souza there. And there's also been floating of Martha Stewart and someone, your doppelganger, Rod Blagojevich, or however you pronounce his name.
Blagojevich.
Choose any one or all three in terms of you think their deservedness of pardoning.
So I'm going to talk instead. I'm going to sidestep that with the grace of Fred Astaire with a vacuum cleaner, Matt. And I'm going to go right to the point of, you know what's really exciting is that Canada, sometime over the summer, they say July 1st, it'll probably take longer than that. But Canada legalized weed because Justin Trudeau, who is mocked mercilessly south of, you know, Ottawa, and actually probably north of Ottawa as well, too. But it was a big part of his campaign when he became Prime Minister of Canada to legalize weed everywhere. That's going into effect over this summer. Part of what he's talking about is expunging and pardoning people who have marijuana-related offenses on their records. California has done this or has started work towards this in the U.S. for, you know, in a state that has legalized recreational marijuana. And so it goes to this issue of pardoning, commuting sentences, expunging records. I am excited as hell that this is happening because this is an issue that is absolutely vital. Like Catherine, it's super important. This is a way that America can reform and evolve and change and make life better for people who have really gotten fucked over in the sense that they may or may not have committed a crime, and it may have been a bad crime, but they have paid their time and they are still in shackles because of something that they did wrong that they have paid their time for and paid their due. So I'm in favor of all of that. And to bring it to Kim Kardashian, the individual who she was actually specifically lobbying for, his pardoning as a kind of marker for what
her
should
pardoning.
Be going on.
I believe that was her grandmother.
Her. Yeah. Thank you. You know, is an example of the rights, the historical wrongs or the criminal justice record that has to be righted. And I, you know, obviously, you know, you like or dislike, you know, celebrities who do political stuff based on whether or not you agree with the cause, not, you know, the fact that they're doing it. I think this is like a really great thing that she's doing. And it's wrong to trivialize, you know, the causes that a lot of celebrities pick up when they are good causes, when they are poorly informed and when their causes are objectively stupid, they deserve to be mocked just like the politicians and activists who push stuff. But this is a really serious thing. And it does show in a larger sense the inability of America, particularly the media, to separate out Trump from the things that are happening under him. And I do think this is a role that libertarians alone are playing, and we're playing it pretty well, and it is not winning us any friends. But it is that when Trump does something good, we say this is a good thing. And when Trump does something awful, we say this is an awful thing. And that is, you know, it's obviously we believe in this kind of disaggregation from, you know, the singer and the song. But it's like that has to become the guiding principle in politics, because otherwise you are just going to be ping ponging back and forth from these just horrible dead enders on both sides who represent fewer and fewer of us. And all they do, and their henchmen and their echo chambers and everything, just drive down public discourse to a point where nothing interesting is being discussed and nothing good is happening.
Possibly to that point, I was on Charles Payne's show on Thursday, I believe, the day that Kardashian met with Trump in the White House to talk about the meeting and the substance behind it. And Charles Payne in the past, who's I'm friendly with, he's kind of has mixed emotions about the drug war and, you know, locking up bad guys or not. And so I was kind of expecting at least a little bit of skepticism there. And what I found, which is I was very heartened to see, not just from him, but one of his guests who was on with me, and also Kimberly Guilfoyle, who was a former prosecutor, and I kind of expect her to come hard on the drug war. They all were not just saying, hey, good, we should get into this prison reform bill, which has passed the House overwhelmingly, I believe, last week. But they also said we should get after mandatory minimum sentencing, which the Trump White House so far through Jeff Sessions and others have shown to be unwilling to do because they're worried about appearing soft on crime or releasing a drug felon or whatever. But to Nick's point about Justin Trudeau, that is the feeder system under which we have this incarceration to begin with. And my hope is that if Trump gets rewarded, with good press or good headlines or good stories or good celebrity visits, by both pardoning people and then hopefully signing a prison reform bill if the Senate passes it, maybe that will be impetus to go after the big stuff, which is mandatory minimum reform and some future other types of criminal justice reform that seemed, frankly, kind of impossible to imagine based on Trump on the campaign trail. And so it's it could be very heartening. We don't have a whole lot of time left, and I want to make sure that we at least get a little bit to the trade war that finally kicked off on, I believe, Friday or Thursday, when whatever May turned into June, the steel and aluminum tariffs that Trump had been threatening for a long time. They finally decided to come through and do it against our three greatest trading partners, Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. Trudeau was pissed. Emmanuel Macron was pissed. Catherine, you were pissed this morning on Slack talking about an appearance that Larry Kudlow made over the weekend. So if you sort of briefly channel your venom.
Yeah, if there's anybody in the Trump administration that I want to like grab by their impeccably tied tie and have a firm word with these days, it's definitely Larry Kudlow, because he knows better than the garbage that he is spewing right now. And he, yesterday or this morning maybe, described Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau as overreacting to the new U.S. tariffs. Now, like, of course he's upset. Of course he's upset. He is. The U.S. economy is, the relationship with the U.S. is one of the most important things to Canada. And Kudlow's response, moreover, was to describe this as a family quarrel and then to say these tariffs may go on for a while or they may not. Like, that is like the worst combination of, like, first of all, an anti-trade policy that has gone into place. Second, uncertainty about the future of that policy, which has been ongoing since the policy was announced. Whether or not there was going to be exceptions, why those exceptions were going to be has been up in the air. Apparently, it's still up in the air. This is a disaster. In order to have free trade, which is the most important engine of poverty alleviation and growth in the world, you have to have certainty. You have to know what's going on. You have to know if you can ship your stuff that you're building now in 1 month or 3 months or a year. And the idea that this is just going to be an ever escalating series of bilateral trade wars and talks and negotiations is nightmarish. He is not overreacting. And neither am I.
But Suderman, how come the economy's so good? Where's my recession?
I'm just irritated that the EU's targeting bourbon, which has been deemed a distinctive product of the United States.
It is.
For retaliatory tariffs.
Yep.
That Does that mean they'll be is, more at home, Peter?
I think
it'll get cheaper here.
I think that what it means is that when whiskey producers here in the United States can't make as much money overseas, they're going to raise prices, which for whiskey, anybody who's buying the brown stuff these days knows that prices have just skyrocketed over the past 5 to 10 years. I think that it means that they're going to try and make it up by charging more to all of us.
But seriously, why aren't we seeing this reflected in the broader economy in a negative way, Peter?
It's a very good question, and in fact,
successes.
I would urge anybody who is interested in that question to read the New York Times report titled something like "We've run out of words to describe how good the job situation is." When the New York Times is publishing that as an analysis by a news writer, not even as some sort of outside opinion, but by a staff news writer, you know it's really actually pretty exceptional. And in particular, that story notes that it's not just that it's quite good right now, but there's no strong sign that it's overheating or that it's going to sort of turn south in the next few months. And I think I would say two things about this. One is that for all of my great frustrations with Donald Trump and for all of the Republican kind of idiocy when it comes to an economic agenda, a lot of what they've done has been not that bad, even okay, even pretty good in some cases, but mostly what they've done is not mess with stuff. And then you combine that with the tax reform bill, which I think has been in some ways totally oversold, but also is not going to irritate or scare off big corporations. I mean, it's just not the sort of thing where they're going to look at that and think, whoa, we're in trouble here. In fact, the opposite. And so in terms of economic policy, I mean, we may well be better off with a president who is distracted with idiot scandals and who is not trying to manage all of this stuff. In some ways, you look at the second half of the 90s when Bill Clinton was president. And that's the last time we were seeing numbers like this in a lot of in many cases. And the economy was pretty great then. The Congress and the presidency were consumed with a culture war squabble about the president's sexual habits. And I don't love that mode of politics, but it may in some ways be an improvement over let's go through and try and manage all of this ourselves from Washington.
So virtuous president undermines economy is now a headline.
I'm not saying I actually definitely think that, but it does strike me as a real possibility.
Well, it is interesting,
what it,
right?
What because it shows both... is also just, you know, the late 90s is also when the World Wide Web kicked into high gear and the tech bubble was inflating like nobody's business. What I would say about the trade war, Matt, is that, you know, it's already been a weekend. And, you know, we kicked Iraq out of Kuwait in a weekend. So the war should be over by now. It's barely starting. More to the point, though, and this goes to Catherine's absolutely righteous outrage at what a lying sack of shit Larry Kudlow is as Trump's economic guy.
And wait, is that our headline?
This goes back to Louis Rossetto saying, you know, what Trump is doing step by step is deconstructing the legitimacy of the presidency. One of the ways he's doing that, and we've talked about this in the past, is by getting people, bringing them into his sphere of administrative influence and getting them to say exactly the opposite of what they actually believe in and are known to believe in, or to disregard them and kind of mock them. Obama did a bunch of this. He did this with his defense secretary, Chuck Hagel. He did it with Christina Romer, his chief of economic advisors. But that's part of what Trump is doing. And it's kind of interesting to watch, but we need to learn from it and reset what the president can and should be doing based on the fact that what Trump is revealing is what Bush and Obama anticipated, which is that the president should not have this power because they are inevitably bad or weak actors.
I would also just add very quickly that the economy was on the upswing through the back half of the Obama presidency. And it may not really be Trump specific at all. It may simply be that when you have a crash of the depth and scale that we had in 2008, that what follows is 10 or 20 years of upswing after that. And that unless you really take meaningful, huge steps to ruin it, which Trump could still do with the trade war or other policies, that unless you really go out of your way to ruin it, the economy just sort of comes back strong after an incident like that.
Don't confuse job reports with the economy, though, because growth is still really subpar, and we've had the longest and slowest recovery from the Great Recession or the financial crisis, however you want to call it. And that continues to be a problem, and it's a problem everywhere in the developed world. And when you start looking at China and India, there are indications that their economic growth rates, which go back to another thing Catherine had said, you know, it's growth that is ultimately what's really key.
But a good jobs picture is a good thing to have. And I would just finally add that, like, while I have been at some points on this podcast, while I have suggested that, you know, November looks like the Republicans are going to take a shellacking, at this rate, with this sort of jobs picture, we're really starting to see the numbers narrow, and sort of the political outlook doesn't look nearly as favorable for Democrats as it did even 6 weeks ago.
I do want to note that Kevin McCarthy says, by the way, guys, said yesterday that we're not in a trade war. He says, I don't think anybody wins a trade war, but we're not in a trade war. We are in a trade discussion to renegotiate NAFTA. So just FYI.
I think it's trade spooning is what we're doing now.
We're in a trade.
I would
canoodle.
Add to the list of garbage fire comments here. Trump's legislative director, Mark Short, said, and this is more delusional than saying the opposite of what he believes, probably, but he imagines that Trump wants at the end of the day is a world with no tariffs. It's like, bro, are you paying any attention at all? That's not how it works. All of the people out there who like, no, we got to get out of all these free trade agreements so that we can really have free trade. No, didn't work out.
Yeah, and by
I'm
the
sorry,
way,
there's
you know,
no evidence
Trump,
for that.
Yeah, over the weekend, Trump was talking about how, like, you know, it's, you know, about deficits, trade deficits and stuff. And I'm like, you know, fuck, I've maintained nothing but trade deficits with virtually every outfit of my life, with the exception of Reason. It's the only thing that gives me more than I give them. And I can't believe I just said that on
as,
air. But
as
you
Catherine
know,
pointed out, you're going to be fired soon.
Man, so I just better not tweet it. So
I'm going to collapse our what are you all reading and say I'm going to answer what we're all reading. What we're all reading is the latest goddamn issue of Reason Magazine, which is awesome. It's an absolute triumph of Catherine Mengu Ward et al. Burn after reading issue that has a special pullout section teaching you. I had no idea that Catherine Mengu Ward of all people had a pot brownie recipe.
Oh, they're
that
so good. They're so good.
Unbelievable.
Are they gluten-free, though, Catherine?
Obviously Kennedy, not, you monster.
Yeah. No, I'm sure Kennedy will have the gluten-free recipe for us
I have a friend with celiac disease who really likes to get fucked up. So
then they should smoke.
You can figure out how to hire a prostitute call girl, make prison hooch at home, surf the web without having the government surveil everything you do. So, Catherine, tell us about some of the funny reaction and response you've gotten out there so far from this. And just congratulations, because it's an awesome issue.
Thank you. People are pretty stoked about this issue. We got a lot of people emailing us asking if they could get a copy of the Dead Tree edition. So we actually have a little special promotion going now. If podcast listeners are interested, if you go to my editor's note about the issue, you can get a link to this. If you subscribe to the magazine right now, we will drop a copy of this issue into first class mail for you right away. So you can get your very own print copy and a year's worth of Reason for a pretty good price. The best reaction so far has been the utter gleeful delight at the video accompaniment to this issue. Mark McDaniel built a gun. He built a Glock. And we made a video about how to do it, as well as a print tutorial. But the thing is that from when we started this project to when we finished it, YouTube changed its terms of service. And that means they no longer host videos that depict the manufacture of firearms. So we made a video first for YouTube about how we are totally fine with YouTube doing that, because YouTube is a private company and they can do whatever they want. However, our video is awesome. And if you want to see it, you should go and see it where we ended up posting it, which was on Pornhub. Because Pornhub totally hosts gun videos, no questions asked. You can also see it at Reason.com if you want to be lame about it. But the sort of two-step of this gun tutorial has been quite a lot of fun. We also got our first notice that this issue was banned in a prison on Friday, which was...
But perhaps not our last.
Yeah, certainly not our last, which is something that I explicitly give a shout-out to in my editor's note. Like, hey, prison censors, you're gonna wanna ban this one. So I think South Dakota wins the dubious honor of being the first to deep six this issue for our incarcerated subscribers. But all around, it's been pretty fun, and I urge y'all to subscribe and check it out.
You know you have a great editor when she says, "Hey, Peter, you want to make some pot infused cocktails and write about it, and hey, maybe serve them to the office."
And also, then you come into the office a week later and there's just a giant jar of weed on your desk.
Yes, that happened.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thank you.
This it's a phenomenal, is the phenomenal issue. And just it's funny, anything that I write about it or mention it, just getting tons of stuff from people being like, how do I get a copy? You know, look into Catherine's note. And, you know, just each everybody seems to have a favorite thing that they want to do. It's really
also
kudos,
real
congrats.
Undervalued piece in this issue, Ron Bailey doing some gene editing in his kitchen. And not just doing gene editing in his kitchen using a CRISPR kit, but like being really sloppy about it. Like the best part of this piece is that Ron's like, I'm not that great at science. So I made this drug resistant E. coli and I don't know, I put some bleach on it afterward. It's probably fine.
Very Rick and Morty.
There is no question that the plague that was talked about in the movie 12 Monkeys just originated sometime in the past couple of months in Charlottesville, Virginia, where Ron lives.
I hear they have a good zoo there.
On that note, not only subscribe to Reason, but subscribe to this podcast, the Reason Podcast, on iTunes, and rate and review us while you're there. We come out with generally three per week. Nick and Catherine and others do interviews there. And before we go, Nick, I know at the end of this week, you're going to be at the FeeCon in Atlanta. What do FeeCon attendees have to look forward to? And why should late-breaking people go and visit?
Oh, you know, if you're in the Atlanta area or if you can get to the Atlanta area, FeeCon runs from the 7th of June to the 9th. Go there. Check out all of the Reason stuff. I'm going to be there. Elizabeth Nolan Brown is going to be there. Austin Bragg and his brother Meredith Bragg are going to be there talking about libertarian videos. We are Robbie Suave, or as some people, I guess, pronounce it, Robé Suave. Is going to be there. Plus, FeeCon has, you know, 60 speakers, 50 plus panels on all sorts of everything about libertarian stuff. Go to reason.com and you'll find a discount coupon as well. You can get 25% off the fee. There's going to be a lot of talking and a lot of doing, Matt. A lot of talking, a lot of doing in Atlanta.
All right.
Hot Atlanta.
25% off the fee.
Yeah.
And with that, thank you for listening. Catch you again next week, and goodbye.